buying a gun for another person who can't legally own a gun could become a felony in Wisconsin. That's if legislation that was passed unanimously in the state Senate gets approved in the assembly. State Senator Alberta Darling sponsored the bill to crack down on so-called straw gun purchases. She's a Republican representing Wisconsin's 8th Senate District, which includes River Falls. Senator Darling, welcome to Central Time.
You bet, Rob. Glad to be on your program.
What led you to want to tackle this straw buyer issue?
Well, I've been working with the police department for, since 2011. And the police department and the chief, the former chief of police, Flynn, said, you know, there are repeat offenders who commit crimes over and over and over again, and we don't have the tools that we need to get these dangerous criminals who shouldn't be carrying weapons in the first place, but they're getting them through straw purchasers or human holsters, and we have to protect the constitutional rights of law-abiding citizens, but we have to get at these repeat offenders who are committing crimes with guns.
It's already, as I understand it, illegal to do this. I couldn't legally buy a gun and then give it to someone who isn't allowed to buy guns. So what changes in your new legislation?
There's a loophole in the law that we're closing so that it makes it very clear that the straw purchaser law, that this individual cannot legally purchase firearms. If the person cannot legally purchase firearms, they can't purchase a firearm on their behalf, and it's closing that loophole. So it's something our police said that we have to do, and we're doing it.
So there was wiggle room in the existing
right,
law.
Yes. While it's already illegal to be a straw purchaser, this bill better defines the crime and makes straw purchasing a felony.
Yeah, and let's talk about that felony part of it. What would that change for someone who is successfully prosecuted under the straw buyer law?
Well, what we would do is be able to get the individual, the repeat of habitual, we're calling them a habitual offender, those who have committed crimes and they have pled down the crime. So anyone who is a habitual criminal would be one who has had committed crimes that have been pled down to misdemeanors. So if they have three misdemeanors or one felony within a five-year period, if they then go on to commit a crime using an illegal gun or committing a crime with a firearm, they can get a mandatory minimum of up to 4 years.
Do you think this will deter people from being a straw buyer in the first place?
Absolutely. I think if the straw purchaser has a felony to look at, that's going to dissuade many of those who currently feel like, oh, I could buy a gun for somebody who cannot legally possess a gun, or I can be that human holster and it'll be okay because nothing will happen to me. Now something will happen to them if they continue to act in this illegal way.
Now, this passed unanimously in the Senate. Are you expecting it to pass the Assembly as well?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, there was a senator who spoke against the bill and wanted to make the misdemeanors violent misdemeanors and actually misinterpreted what we were trying to do, because what we're trying to do is to say that if you commit a crime when you are not able to carry a gun, and if you have a gun or if you commit a crime with that gun, you're going to have consequences that are going to be significant. And this was asked for by our police department, who said, look, we get into issues where these people commit crime after crime after crime with guns, but it's plea bargained down, and they have misdemeanors, and nothing really serious happens to them until they do something really serious or get killed themselves. So this is going to be, I bet, a huge deterrent, and it will give the police, most importantly, the tools they need to attack these habitual offenders who right now are getting off crimes committed with guns, and they plead them down because somebody else is a straw purchaser or somebody else will take that gun when they are at the site of the crime, and they cannot be charged with a crime with a gun. So we're giving the police the tools that they need.
Senator Darling, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
That was State Senator Alberta Darling, a Republican representing Wisconsin's 8th District, which includes River Hills. She joined us today to talk about the bill she sponsored that would make it a felony for someone to buy a gun for someone who cannot have one legally. The bill passed in the state Senate. It's now in the Assembly. Now the state Assembly ends its legislative session today. Among the items that have already passed are juvenile justice reforms, rent-to-own regulations, and changes to self-insurance. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's been covering a busy last couple days of this session. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Laurel, I said busy, and that's an understatement, right?
It is an understatement. I think one of the lawmakers last week used the word chaotic to describe this week, kind of looking forward to it. And I think he was incredibly on point with that word choice.
Well, it's hard to know where to start, but let's go to justice reform, juvenile justice reform in particular, the Lincoln Hills School for Boys, the Copper Lake School for Girls, years-long controversy. What has ended up happening there?
So the Assembly took up that bill yesterday, and they unanimously passed the bill, which would close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake by 2021, and also reorganize the state's juvenile justice system pretty substantially. It would move inmates who are currently at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake to regional facilities across the state of Wisconsin, so kind of smaller facilities that proponents say are going to be closer to their families, so they're going to be more effective at rehabilitating youth. Now that, as I said, that passed unanimously from the Assembly yesterday, it still has to go to the state Senate before it goes to the governor's desk.
I understand in the state Senate, it's not a sure thing.
Well, the Senate, that's right. So the Senate is considering a variety of proposals that are moving through the Assembly right now. And we're constantly kind of checking back with the Senate Majority Leader to say, what do you guys think about this? What do you think about that? And the response on a lot of these high-profile bills is we're still talking about it, we're still working through it, and the Senate isn't scheduled to be in to make those votes until March, so they've got a little bit of time to consider it.
I want to give a listen to State Representative Evan Goyke, Democrat from Milwaukee, who's been pushing for juvenile justice changes for a while. He says this bill could help reduce crime among younger people. Here's a listen.
Connecting with those 15 and 16-year-olds and giving them that rock in that moment of crisis, that little bit of structure in a chaotic moment, means that they go home to their family or to their guardians or to their schools a little bit stronger, a little bit more stable, a little less likely to engage in risky criminal behavior.
So is he talking there about what the new system would be like for juvenile offenders as opposed to what they're getting currently at Lincoln Hills?
That's right. So there were a lot of very supportive speeches on the floor yesterday, as you would imagine, with a unanimous vote. And Goyke was hitting on a couple of the really common points there, which were that the new organization of the juvenile justice system after Lincoln Hills would close in 2021 and those new facilities would open, would be that it would discourage recidivism, so young people getting back into the criminal justice system, either again as juveniles or as adults, that it would discourage juvenile crime overall, and just that it's going to send a positive message to the youth that are incarcerated, that the state is expending resources on them, on their rehabilitation, and sort of the idea that that gives them hope and incentive to be productive citizens when they go back into society.
Laurel White is with us, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's with us to talk about the bills being considered and passed in the state assembly before their session ends. We'll get to some other pieces of legislation coming up in just a few moments. We continue our conversation with Laurel White, WPR state capitol reporter, looking at a busy stretch, a busy end to the legislative session, especially in the state assembly. She's been keeping up with a lot of action there. Laurel, rent-to-own businesses, regulations changing there. What's happening?
So the Assembly passed this bill on Tuesday, and this is actually a pretty big deal, Rob, because this bill has been coming up in the Capitol, and rent-to-own industry individuals have been pushing it for longer than I have been alive. So it's passed the legislature a couple times, but has been vetoed by various governors. What it would do is that it would change regulation of rent-to-own businesses in Wisconsin. So for people that aren't familiar, rent-to-own businesses do things like they rent TVs or, you know, other household items, couches, to people who can't buy them outright for whatever reason, if they don't have the money or they don't have the credit. And these rent-to-own businesses can sometimes charge interest rates up to 200%. So some people that are opposed to them say that they really take advantage of vulnerable populations, people who don't have good credit, things like that. And what this bill would do is create a new set of regulations. It would exempt rent-to-own from the Wisconsin Consumer Act that they're currently under and create a whole new set of regulations specifically for them.
And so what would change as far as what they have to tell consumers?
So basically what would change is related to that interest rate. So right now, rent-to-own companies don't have to publicize their interest rates, which, you know, can be pretty high, as I said. And under the bill, they would no longer have to do that.
So they're currently required to. They wouldn't have to anymore. What's been the pushback over the years and in the assembly for those who didn't vote for this, though it did end up passing the assembly?
So Democrats, the majority of people that voted against it were Democrats. There was one Republican in the assembly on Tuesday that joined them to vote against it. And they just say that the current regulations in Wisconsin are effective, you know, requiring them to publicize those interest rates is providing adequate protections for consumers. That's something that they really want to see continue in the state. We have rent-to-own businesses in Wisconsin, obviously, but we have fewer than other states that have different regulations. So opponents are saying if we pass these new regulations that are a little bit more lenient, we're going to get a lot more rent-to-own businesses in the state of Wisconsin, and the proliferation of what they say is taking advantage of low-income people, vulnerable populations, people with bad credit is going to expand.
This one would still have to go through the Senate, right?
That's right. It still has to go through the Senate.
Okay, quick lightning round on a couple other things. A self-funding insurance option for small businesses also passed by the Assembly. What would this do?
So this would allow small businesses, if they're under the same Chamber of Commerce, I believe, to band together to self-fund employee insurance. So some big companies do this, and basically what supporters of this bill are saying is that small companies don't have the resources, or it's pretty difficult for them to have a self-insurance plan for employees that basically they pay for, employees pay into it, they pay out claims, things like that. And so they want to make it more affordable for small businesses to have that sort of option if they want to provide employees health insurance. So under the plan, they could form these employer groups, which are a certain number of small businesses as long as they're in the same area, and then they could offer this type of insurance to their employees.
And then this is a special session on changes to the welfare system as called by Governor Walker. What has happened to the various pieces of legislation he was pushing for?
So they have all passed now, with the exception of one. And they're headed to the governor's desk, and of course he's going to sign them. The one bill that did not pass, they got the final approval from the Senate earlier this week, was a bill that would implement photo IDs for food stamp recipients.
But the changes, what are some of the key changes that have passed and are now on their way to the governor's desk?
So a big one would be increasing work requirements for people who get things like food stamps. The work requirement would go from 20 hours a week to 30 hours a week. And it would also expand to people who have children over the age of 6. Under current law previously, before this passed, those individuals with kids were exempted from the work requirements. And they're not just work, it's worker training as well. So if you engage in a state-run worker training program to help you build skills, that also qualifies you to get food stamps.
This is the last day now, the assembly session, right? Are they still trying to hammer some things out before they go home?
Oh, gosh, yes. They have a lot of things on their calendar today, Rob. So what they're actually debating right now, and I think at some points during our interview you might be able to hear them in the background, but they're talking about the child tax credit and sales tax holiday right now. So that would give people with children under 18 a $100 check and implement a sales tax holiday the first weekend in August.
And there's been argument about the timing of that check, right?
Right. Democrats are pushing back and saying that it's a political gimmick to send people with kids a $100 check right before the fall elections.
Is this one of those days, Laurel, where you're going to have to be pretty well caffeinated at this point to make it through to the end?
Yes, I'm surrounded by coffee cups, if you could see me.
We'll leave it there. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joins today to talk about a busy end to the legislative session for the state assembly. You can follow developments through the night over at WPR.org/news. The kids, they love cartoons, and our next guest noticed how often the villains in cartoons have a foreign-sounding accent or dialect. But what message does that send to kids when all the bad guys sound different than them?
Now our boys are on the way to California, unaware that Bullwinkle's mattress full of money is the target of two pairs of sinister eyes belonging to... Oh, no, it isn't. Oh, it can't be.
Say the name.
Boris and Natasha.
Ta-da!
Then we steal mattress, Boris.
No time like the president, Natasha. Look, we're coming to tunnel. When it gets dark, we grab mattress and make a run for it, okay?
Okay!
It's Boris and Natasha, bad guys in the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. Calvin Gidney is an associate professor in the Elliott Pearson Department of Child Study and Human Development at Tufts University. Calvin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, what first got you interested in looking at the foreign accents of so many cartoon bad guys?
Well, it goes back to when I first saw The Lion King, the Disney movie, in theaters. You know, I'm a sociolinguist, so I'm particularly interested in language variation. And when I saw The Lion King, I was shocked and unpleasantly surprised by how the movie used dialect to signal whether a character was a good character or a bad character. So that was the start of it.
Break it down in The Lion King for us. Who had, what accents did the good guys have, and what accents did the bad guys have?
Sure. So you'll remember the Lion King movie. They're the good lions, like Mufasa and Simba, and they all speak a dialect that we linguists call standard American English. It's a dialect you and I are speaking right now. It's what you hear on the radio, and it's kind of devoid of regional accents or ways to identify things. Then, for some reason, inexplicably, Mufasa's brother, Scar, speaks with a British accent. And when I first heard that, I thought, okay, that's strange. Maybe he spent some time in a zoo in Oxford or something. Why would his brother have a different dialect? Then if you take the hyenas that the evil Scar sort of co-opts into working for him, one of those hyenas has a really recognizable African-American dialect. That was the hyena voiced by Whoopi Goldberg. And then the other one has a very noticeable Spanish-accented English, and that was the one that was voiced by Cheech Marin. And suddenly, there's a whole universe about good characters and bad characters and how they sound, and I thought that was really pernicious messaging.
And once you start looking, it's hard to stop finding these. Here's another Disney example, Jafar from the movie Aladdin.
Mm-hmm. Jafar, I order you to stop.
Ah, but there's a new order now. My order. Finally, you will bow to me.
We will never bow to you.
Why am I not surprised?
If you won't bow before a sultan, then you will cower before a sorcerer. Genie, my second wish. I wish to be...
So there we have American accents, British-accented bad guy, and whatever Gilbert Gottfried is.
That's right. Gilbert Gottfried is... I mean, that clip is a perfect clip because it really illustrates the way that movies, particularly cartoons, use voices as a sort of shorthand to children and to other people watching that a character is either a good character, a bad character, or just a funny character like Gilbert Gottfried's character.
Now, before we get into what you did in your research... Why? Why is this important for kids if some bad guys, many bad guys, have some kind of different outsider accent?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, children are learning from their environment, and they learn messages that we teach them explicitly, but almost as importantly, they learn messages implicitly, the things that we don't actually teach them, but they notice about the world. And we know as adults that just because you have a particular accent or dialect doesn't mean that you're necessarily a good person or a bad person. There are people who speak all different kinds of dialects and accents that are either good or bad or funny or not funny. And we shouldn't use a person's accent as a shorthand for that. So I think I want to combat stereotyping, that type of stereotyping.
So let's get into the details of the study now. With all this in mind, what did you start digging for?
Well, the first thing I did was come in and talk to a colleague of mine, Dr. Julie Dobrow, who is a specialist in children's media. And I was complaining about The Lion King, and she said, you know, we ought to study that in children's cartoons. So what we've done for the past 4 years is we take the top 10 shows that children between the ages of 6 and 11 are watching, and we're sure to include a number of different types of networks like public television like Arthur, or cable TV like Disney or Nickelodeon, or network TV. And we take 3 episodes of each, and then undergraduates and graduate students do the painstaking task of listening to every single speaking character in there and coding them for different linguistic features, the dialect and the accent they speak with, the types of words that they use, their intonation and such. So we have, after 3 years, and we're now in year number 4, but 3 years, we've got 90 episodes of 30 different shows coded, and we have about 4,000 different characters coded.
Wow. That's huge. So now you're starting to see patterns. What do you find out after you look at the work and the way they've classified the different speakers in these cartoons?
Well, I mean, I guess the first and perhaps most obvious is that heroes and heroines speak standard American English in things that are dubbed or made in the U.S. or in Canada. That's the dialect they choose for heroes and heroines. When you find dialects or varieties of English that are not those dialects, they're often relegated to certain types of roles. So, for example, if you often find a set of dialects that an American might recognize as sort of working class New York or urban, that sort of, the lime pits is already dug, boss, that kind of thing, you'll find that particular accent almost exclusively as criminals and people who are disreputable, right? So that they use that as a shorthand. Then if you find certain accents of evil characters, even in the 21st century, we're finding sort of German-type accents used to show that a character is somehow evil. For example, in one of the cartoons is a character named Doofenshmirtz.
Right, is a
German last name, in Phineas and Ferb. And he has a sort of, it's not exactly German, a German speaker wouldn't recognize it as German, but we would as American English speakers recognize it as a sort of German accent. And then you have British English dialects, which is kind of interesting because, you know, I think Americans, we have sort of ambivalent views about British English. On the one hand, we think that way that the Queen speaks, which linguists called received pronunciation, we think of that as very eloquent and elegant. But on the other hand, you'll find a lot of evil geniuses like Scar or like Jafar have a British accent. So, you know, we have an ambivalent view of it. It's either a sidekick or somebody very elegant, or it's somebody who's sort of malevolent.
I want to key in on the Central and Eastern European part, because there's the Germanic ones and there's the Boris and Natasha's with their sort of cinematic, comical Russian accents. Why do we find those simultaneously evil and funny?
Well, I think we find them... I think they're both, because number one, a lot of times, along with just the accent, in other words, the way they pronounce things, they also might have grammatical differences. So, for example, Boris and Natasha, to go back to the Bullwinkle, they also have certain characteristics that actual Russian speakers have. Like in Russian, there are no articles, words like the and a. So Boris and Natasha say moose and squirrel instead of the moose and the squirrel. So that's funny to us because that actually is how some Russians learning English might speak English. So it's funny because it is describing something real. But at the same time, the insidious part is that we come to associate that accent with being somewhat sinister.
Let's bring it back around to kids now. And I understand you're going to be doing more work on this. How do we find out if, you know, being exposed to this idea that, hey, people who talk a certain way are particular kinds of people, how do we figure out how that affects kids?
Well, you know, we are right now at the start of that process. What we're going to do is we're going to work with kids in first and second grade in a variety of different places, including in California and Louisiana and in the Boston area as well, where we're located. And we're going to play them different voices, and we're going to ask their opinions about what they think of that character's voice. I mean, you know, you always have to do a little bit of deception with young kids when you're doing something like this. You can't just ask them their attitude toward a dialect. So what we tell them is that we're trying to make a TV show, and we'd like their help deciding what to do with these different voices and characters. Should that character be a good character or a bad character? And then we ask a couple of questions about the characters. Are they funny? Are they not funny? Do we think that they're going to be smart or not smart? And then we ask if they're going to be the hero or the villain or a sidekick. So that, and you'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be surprised, many 6-year-olds have very definite attitudes and ideas about what they want to be in their show. And so far, we've just done a pilot study so far with 20 kids. So far, it's pretty clear that if the voice we play kids speaks standard American English, they're likely to say, oh, that's going to be the hero or the heroine, depending on if it's a male or female voice. And we haven't yet found one of the kids in our sample say that the standard voice is a sidekick or is a funny character.
And Calvin, I can't let you go. You mentioned you looked at PBS shows. We've got a lot of public media fans out there. How did PBS kids shows do when it came to these accents?
Do you know something? In some ways, a lot better. And in other ways, speaking from my own perspective as a sociolinguist, there's still room for improvement. So some of the PBS shows that we looked at included Arthur, which is a great show, Magic School Bus, Word Girl, and The Adventures of Maya and Miguel. And with the exception of that last show, The Adventures of Maya and Miguel, what you find in those other shows is pretty typical, like in Arthur. The characters all look different. In other words, the characters in Arthur, some are blue and some are orange and, you know, whatnot. But they all kind of speak the same. So it sort of gets rid of linguistic diversity, and all of the characters just speak standard American English. And personally, I don't think that's exactly the right message either, because we live in a country that is diverse and that has a lot of different wonderful, beautiful, regional, and ethnic accents.
We'll leave it there, Calvin. Thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Calvin Gidney, Associate Professor of Child Study and Human Development at Tufts University. We've been talking about his study on accents and children's entertainment.